I think it's as clear as ever that what we believe really does matter in this world. It has been a custom for many years in this congregation to invite members and friends to share their credos with the congregation during a worship service. I'm not sure when the tradition started, but I know it's been many years. This year, we are grateful to have David and Ellen Schoenfeld sharing theirs. David and Ellen have been members of this church for many years and have between them held many roles in the community, and I'm not even sure what they all are, but I know that David is currently serving on the stewardship committee and that Ellen is currently serving on buildings and grounds, mostly focusing on grounds and on the memorial garden, and that she's also deeply committed to social justice and involved the time that I've known her with BIC, the Brockton Interfaith Community. Unitarian Universalism is a non-creedal tradition, as I reminded the families and children that gathered earlier at the 10 o'clock service, meaning that there is no commonly held creed. When one joins this congregation, one is not asked to subscribe to a certain set of beliefs. Instead, you are encouraged to do what I think is the both freeing and also very difficult work of exploring your own beliefs, trying to figure out what it is that you believe based not only on what you were once taught, but also on what you have since learned and experienced. The word credo simply means I believe. And so these credos that we are about to hear reflect to some extent and in some way where Ellen and David's journeys have taken them, where they find themselves at this point in their lives. As an interim minister, I am grateful that I will have the opportunity to hear these credos. I wasn't able to be here at the service last year, but I think this is such a wonderful tradition that I look forward to sharing it with the next congregation that I am invited to serve. So thank you both for agreeing to share and for being with us this morning.
As I get older, I find myself less sure of what I believe and how I should act on the belief. And I think I love the phrase from Bob Dylan when talking about his youthful beliefs. He says, "I was so much older then, I'm younger than that now." In a sense, there's a continuum between knowledge and make-believe, with beliefs sitting somewhere in the middle. Knowledge is the very rare situation where we learn something either by direct experience or by mathematical proof. Most things we know are things we take on authority, and these are in the continuum of belief. Although when I thought about this over again, I wondered whether I really believed that actually. but in any case, make-believe, the thing I'm calling make-believe, can be a powerful force in our lives as we act on something as though we know it, despite the fact that we know it may be just partially true. So where I put things I used to feel strongly about on this continuum of belief changes constantly. So I've decided to present my credo by giving the history of my beliefs, sort of starting from what I learned from my parents and hopefully to the present time. So first, my parents were communists. This is hard to say because I lived through the McCarthy era and I was told to keep quiet about this, that my parents were communists, but they were communists, members of the American Communist Party. They didn't believe in God. In fact, they believed that religion was the opiate of the masses. And the basic belief of communism, which I'm going to describe, is that history is determined by the constant struggle between the rulers and the ruled. In the present time, when the rulers are the capitalist class and the ruled are the working class, history has reached a very unique turning point, and where the working class can seize the means of production, create a socialist society, which would eventually evolve into a communist society. And a communist society is one in which government basically administers things, not people, and where the maxim is from each according to their ability to each according to their need. So did I believe this as a child? Did my parents believe it? Well, maybe. I mean, it was somewhere on this continuum between belief and make-believe. I guess we hoped it. The working class didn't seem ready for a socialist revolution in the 1950s, nor do they now, but maybe someday, and hopefully before the ocean rises and swallows us up. I wasn't outspoken about being a communist in middle school. After all, this was the 50s, and the communists were quite unpopular. But I was very outspoken about being an atheist, which ran afoul of the Boy Scouts, which was my most important social outlet. And so what I remember was, I remember this like it was yesterday, the scoutmaster coming to our house to talk to us about it. And what he suggested is that we bend over backwards about this, i.e., because the Boy Scouts didn't tolerate atheism. So basically, I learned hypocrisy in the Boy Scouts. So one of the things that my parents did was to have me bar mitzvahed. And ostensibly, they said it was because of the Boy Scouts, but I think they also wanted to have the party. So we had a great party. We had a great party in my backyard, and all my relatives and friends came. It wasn't the kind of bar mitzvahs they have in Sharon at country clubs. In Yiddish, it would be a hamisha bar mitzvah. Anyway, but I did learn something about Judaism in the process of being bar mitzvahed, and basically, I began to search for religious experience. And I did this by not being too concerned about the line between belief and make-believe. So I remained an atheist, but I figured I could have truly, truly spiritual experiences. And to explain this concept further, I will jump ahead quite a few years. In 1978, my brother was killed by the driver of an automobile. We had been very close. Nothing as bad as this had happened to me before or since. And his funeral, given our family, was completely secular, except for we recited the mourner's Kaddish, which is a prayer in Aramaic, which is recited in every Jewish service by those who had a death in their family during the past year. So if you go to Jewish services, which, although we were atheists, we had all Jewish friends, we went to many Jewish services, you hear this prayer over and over again. You can nearly recite it from memory. But you're not a mourner, you hear it. But now I was a mourner. The prayer had an incredibly powerful effect on me because it reminded me how commonplace death was, how people had mourned for millennia before me, and it connected me with all of those mourners. And now at 74, thinking about it, it connects me to my own mortality, when at some point I will be mourned. So this is sort of to discuss religious experience in the context of being an atheist. So now I'm going back to other history, other beliefs. In 1968, I lost my student deferment and risked being drafted to fight in the American War in Vietnam. A war which I had been, wow, I'm running out of time, which I had been opposed to. And this catapulted me into activism. And at that point, I sort of became a pacifist anarchist. So I sort of gravitated into the movement of David Harris and Joan Baez. And we also believed that eventually society would be transformed by, again, non-cooperation. And did I really believe in pacifism? Well, I'm not sure. It was a very attractive kind of belief, but I'm not sure I fully believed in it. I began morphing back to communism because after that I joined the Student for Democratic Society. And we got into they were more communist belief. I did have experience with both things, with both non-cooperation, pacifism, and the students of democratic style revolution. The pacifist was, I was sat in a draft board and was maced. And the policemen sprayed us with this mace like we were insects. And my decision on this was that I would never do this again with 30 people getting maced. It may have seemed dramatic, but it was not effective. And then I had an experience with SDS where one of our protests turned into a riot. And it soured me on the notion of revolution as well. When people sort of feel that they can do anything because in the cover of darkness with all these other people doing things, it just gets very ugly and very frightening. So what do I believe now? Well, I've sort of looked closely. I still don't believe in God, but I believe that a belief in God isn't very fantastic at all. I mean, if you look at the theory of the multiverse, for instance, it seems pretty fantastic as well. Sometimes science seems as fantastic as religion, and I've read a book about that argues for God's existence using Occam's razor, which basically is that it's a simpler explanation than any other. And it's a strange book. It's very interesting because it does argue for the existence. It makes a very rational argument for the existence of God, but the God it's arguing for is rather a supernatural explanation for things, but isn't really conscious and doesn't reward and punish. So, I mean, I think that the concept of God is very amorphous, and people can have different kinds of concepts about this. And sometimes I make believe there is a God in order to have a target for gratitude or the lack of gratitude. And I feel it doesn't bother me to do that, because again, belief is a continuum between make believe and knowledge. I subscribe to the humanist belief that people are basically good and do bad things because they lose perspective or don't know any better, but I'm somewhat skeptical about this as well. If good people do bad things, what defines a good person? I worry about things that I might be doing that are bad. I worry about things that I might be doing are bad. For instance, eating meat. If animals are conscious like us, I shouldn't eat meat. But I do eat meat. Is the goodness of man a vacuous statement? So I'm going to end this talk on a more positive note. I really believe in the value of this church. What draws me here is we have created a loving community with rather simple and sometimes unwritten rules about how to behave and a shared commitment to building the community. And this community has been a powerful positive force in my life, and I'm fully committed to helping it thrive and offering it to others. Thank you for your attention.
How many of you have done a credo here from this podium? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16. Don't you think we should all have to do a credo? Yeah. All right. I just wanted... I'm not talking about my history like David. I'm talking about my present beliefs. So I'm just going to share a couple books with you. Stamped From the Beginning by Ibram Kendi is a fantastic book. And White Fragility, which, how many people are reading this? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Okay, on the bestseller list, besides a lot of you are reading it. So, Here I go. I believe I am like an onion. My essence, those traits with which I was born, is enshrouded under layers of socialization. One of those layers represents a group I had hitherto not consciously identified with, the white race. I have been ignorant of this layer and how it has had a profound effect on my worldview. My beliefs come from my worldview. As my worldview becomes more informed by examining those layers, my beliefs become more nuanced. I suppose if I believed my beliefs were static, then every time I learned something in contradiction, I'd have a crisis of faith. But since my faith is to be open to truth and meaning, then this is obviously not a problem. And it's okay that my worldview is not the same as yesterday. The book, White Fragility, recently two happenings are causing a shift in my worldview. The book, White Fragility, by Robin DiAngelo, and the ideas from the community organizing workshops with Will Dickerson, the executive director of BIC, Brockton Interfaith Community, have helped me understand how our long history, about 400 years, of racism in this country has affected me as a white person. I look at any and all events today with a racial lens. You can tell by the fact that I've stapled things together, I tried to shorten this talk. Here are some of my current beliefs. I believe societal hypocrisy, our inability to align what we say we believe with reality, is toxic in many ways and deeply shaming us as individuals. I believe I am not living in a colorblind world. Race may be a human construct, but I will work to see how the messages of being white have informed my life. While I still believe that people aim to be mostly good and not bad, I feel that this distinction is irrelevant. Instead, people go with their self-interest, and this self-interest is heavily informed by layers of socialization. I believe that our inability to affect societal change rests in the structural racism that has been our history for 400 years. And I believe white people play a part in dismantling racism. Read the book. Whoops. I will read you just a little bit from the intro. And it says, if I understand racism as a system into which I was socialized, I can receive feedback on my problematic racial patterns as a helpful way to support my learning and growth. One of the greatest social fears for a white person is being told, this is especially true for liberals, I understand, one of the greatest social fears for a white person is being told that something that we have said or done is racially problematic. Yet when someone lets us know that we have done such a thing, rather than respond with gratitude and relief, after all, now that we are informed, we won't do it again, we often respond with anger and denial. Such moments can be experienced as something valuable, even if temporarily painful, only after we accept that racism is unavoidable and that it is impossible to completely escape having developed problematic racial assumptions and behaviors. For me, engaging in this work requires a certain attitude, being humble, open, curious, and grateful to be doing this work. I believe that the following behaviors or guidelines will help me maintain this attitude, or hopefully. They are part of the dialogue process. I will listen more than I talk, notice my reactions, and put them aside to think about later. I will speak and listen from the heart. I will speak and listen to understand, not to be understood. I will be present, meaning I won't stop listening in order to pre-plan a response. All these are easy in concept and much harder in practice, as we all know. So I want to read a little bit more from White Fragility to close because I want you to hear the basic assumptions of the author. This is the first paragraph of the first chapter, so not very far into it. And it says, I am a white American raised in the United States. I have a white frame of reference and a white worldview, and I move through the world with a white experience. My experience is not a universal human experience. It is a particularly white experience in a society in which race matters profoundly, a society that is deeply separate and unequal by race. However, like most white people raised in the US, I am not taught to see myself in racial terms, and certainly not to draw attention to my race or to behave as if it mattered in any way. Of course, I was made aware that somebody's race mattered, and if race was discussed, it would be theirs, not mine. Yet, a critical component of cross-racial skill building is the ability to sit with the discomfort of being seen racially, and of having to proceed as if our race matters, which it does. Being seen racially is a common trigger of white fragility, and thus, to build our stamina, white people must face the first challenge, naming our race. And I believe and agree with Robin DiAngelo when she ends her book by saying that this will be messy, lifelong work, but necessary to align my professed values with my real actions. And that was the end until I discovered this quote by James Baldwin from Nobody Knows My Name, More Notes of a Native Son from 1961. This quote is adapted to use by using inclusive gender language. Any real change implies the breakup of the world as one has always known it, the loss of all that gave one an identity, and the end of safety. And at such a moment, unable to see and not daring to imagine what the future will now bring forth, one clings to what one knew or dreamed that one possessed. Yet it is only when a person is able, without bitterness or self-pity, to surrender a dream they have long cherished or a privilege they have long possessed, that they are set free. They have set themselves free for higher dreams and for greater privileges. The end.